different states are hurting at a completely different level, right? So yesterday I was looking at Utah's numbers. Davis County, where we're building a new industrial asset, is at 4.7% unemployment at the end of June. 4.7%. Detroit is at 40%, right? So 4 out of 10 people in Detroit. So there is one city worse than Las Vegas at this point in time, and that's Detroit, right? So Vegas is right after that, and then Orlando. And so when we're looking at these, we're seeing a pattern of cities that were fundamentally very, very strong before the pandemic with jobs are coming back faster.
I'm Neil.
And I'm Brittany.
We are a family on a journey towards financial and location independence. Each week, we interview successful real estate entrepreneurs about their chosen investment strategy and rate it based on how much money it took to get started, how long it took to educate themselves, how passive it is, and whether or not they could do it from anywhere in the world.
Welcome to the Road to Family Freedom.
Before we begin this week's show, I'd like to make you an offer, a free 30-minute call with me. We've been doing weekly chats with other real estate investors for months now, and the response has been great. But we're going to change things up a bit and focus. We are buying self-storage facilities. We have a great partner in North Carolina with a great track record of success, a background in construction, and we're partnering up to help him expand his portfolio. If you have an interest in learning more about investing in self-storage, on the active side, on the passive side, whatever your level of interest, we want to talk to you. There's no pitch here. We're not selling a coaching program. This is just a chance for us to network with other investors interested in self-storage. Also, if you're a current self-storage owner, we'd love to chat with you and perhaps have you as a guest on our show. If all that sounds like something you'd be interested in, go to roadtofamilyfreedom.com/self-storage call and schedule a call there. I look forward to speaking with you.
All right, enough out of us. Let's hit the road to family freedom.
Greetings, friends and families. I'm Neil.
And I'm Brittany.
And you're listening to the Road to Family Freedom podcast. Our guest this week is a technologist who's universally known in the real estate circles as the mad scientist of multifamily. He's a data guru, a man after my own heart, a process freak, and an outsourcing expert. Neil Bawa, welcome to the Road to Family Freedom.
Thanks for having me on the show. It's good to be on a show with another Neil.
I know. I can't approve of how you spell it, though. I just.
Oh yes. So I have to tell you about that. I mean, when I stepped away from my technology career, I was still using my Indian name, Navraj, and most people knew me as Nav, N-A-V, like navigator, right? And so I was like, but in real estate, you've got to have an American name. I mean, it's needed. So when I started looking at this, I was like, you know, Neil was something that I was very attracted to. Neil Armstrong, the astronaut's always been one of my idols. You know, I'm a geek, right? So, I mean, what's more geeky than people landing on the moon? And so I was like, I want his name. But then I was like, no, but, you know, there's a lot of Neils out there. So then I started researching versions of it, and it turned out that the Irish version, N-E-A-L, sometimes it's also used as the last name. So there's a lot of people with the last name Neil. And I realized that there are no Neil Bawas on the internet with N-E-A-L. So I was like, okay, for better and for worse, I'm going to be the only Neil Bawa on the World Wide Web. And so many years later, I still am. So if you Google my name, you'll find all the good stuff and all the bad stuff about me. I haven't found the bad stuff yet, but I'm sure it exists.
Yeah, I have sort of the opposite problem. Neil Henderson, and especially the way I spell it, is actually a very, very common name. I think the most famous is an Irish fireworks show expert or something. And so I get people kind of emailing me about that.
I have a tennis player, some kind of professional tennis player I should just be my maiden name, Brittany Deering. That's way less common, but you gave me Henderson, and now I get emails and social media things occasionally where I've been tagged as a tennis player. I'm like, nope, wrong one, nutritionist.
Okay, well, so the last time I saw you was February of this last year at the best ever real estate conference in Colorado, and you were on a panel doing an Oxford-style debate with Jillian Hellman. And arguing quite eloquently that the best days of multifamily were behind us. And then March 2020 happens, and the whole world comes apart. And I know that in actuality, you're actually quite bullish
on multifamily. But have you felt at all prophetic over the last 6 months or so?
God, no, absolutely not. I think that this was one of those panels where, you know, normally you have a panel and people are basically agreeing with each other. And it's like, I don't want to be on those panels. I want to be in a, like a full scale battle. So they said, we have a debate instead of a panel. Would you like to chair the debate? And I was like, sure. But I'm really aggressive on debates because I know in a debate, you don't look at the other side. You're completely one sided. And so I need to be up against somebody that's really strong. And so the organizer comes back and says, oh, we've got Jillian Hellman. She's really strong. So I was like, that's going to be fun, right? So that debate was not really about my beliefs. It was about taking one side and hammering it home. And if you notice, I gave Jillian fair warning and said, you know, I'm going to go after you. And she's like, I'm going to go after you, Neil. Right. And so it was no holds barred. It was a very aggressive, you know, thing. And we got an email immediately after the conference. That was the number one rated segment of the conference. And I think it was simply because it was so aggressive and people really enjoyed that. But no, definitely not feeling prophetic because some of that was really acting more than belief. It is not my belief is that in the short term, the best days of multifamily are behind it. And COVID changed that. So now the next 18 months are going to be incredibly rough for everybody. Most people think like we've weathered the storm and they don't understand the concept of how real estate works. And it's far too soon to weather anything. We're just getting started here. The next 18 months are really tough. But because of COVID and because of the $4 trillion that we just injected into the U.S. economy and the $10 trillion of stimulus injected into the world economy, the best days of multifamily are now ahead of it. And you know, we can talk about, you know, what cap compression means and why it occurs outside of real estate. But basically, we restarted the multifamily boom cycle, but the restart has a 12 to 18 month very rough patch. And basically, that patch starts, we're reporting this on July 30th, it starts on August 1st. 2 days from today, because today people have unemployment benefits. 2 days from now, they don't.
Yeah.
Oops. Yeah. I think you guys froze there for a second on my side.
Yeah, no.
Oh, we recorded it all. We got your voice, so
yeah.
We're good.
Okay. Yeah, that's what I keep telling people. You know, people are like, well, you know, where are the real estate deals? You know, the economy's crashing. There should be some real estate deals right now and housing prices should be dropping and yada, yada, yada. And it's like, there's still too much government cheddar out there. There's
anything to happen, right?
Anything to happen. Yeah, it's
every market. Yeah. Every market's supported right now.
Yeah. No, it's a very strange, No, we sold our home here in Las Vegas about a month ago, and I did that because we bought back in 2013 at the bottom of the market. We'd had a huge run-up in equity, and I'd been through the 2008 cycle. I'd ridden that down and then saw what happened to real estate here in Las Vegas. Now, there's no guarantee it's going to happen again, but we're at 30% unemployment in the state of Nevada, which is the highest in the union. There's no way that doesn't impact the economy and real estate. There's just absolutely no way. And I'd rather be wrong in the other direction than right. You know,
I got to tell you, I think the Hendersons got it right. I couldn't think of a better time to sell in Vegas. I mean, Vegas has had an amazing run in the last 7 years, better than most metros in the U.S. to be honest. So that run up has been, phenomenal. And I think that all run-ups end. And Vegas is going to be hit extraordinarily hard. I think that if I had to pick two cities in the U.S. that are going to be the hardest hit from this particular pandemic, it's going to be Vegas and Detroit. When I am looking at what is going to happen to the balance sheet of the MGM, I'm looking at what's going to happen to, all of the big players in Vegas. The damage to the balance sheet is so excessive and so phenomenal that they're going to be struggling for years, even if 2 months from now we get a vaccine and things resume, right? So people are like, yeah, things can resume. Yes, but the balance sheet damage is done. What is done is done. They still had to pay their hundreds of millions of dollars of loans it during this time, and they've been scrounging and they've been basically leveraging their other assets, and there's no way to undo that damage, and it's going to take a very long time. So in my mind, you'll see bankruptcies in Vegas, large ones, really in 2021. I don't foresee seeing a lot of them in 2020. You know, some of these are well capitalized. It's going to take them a while before they resort to bankruptcy last option. People are like, oh yeah, we'll just declare bankruptcy and write it off. I mean, they don't understand that for business, that's the very last step, because you lose your leverage capability, you lose your ability or methods. Some very, very large bankruptcies in Vegas in 2021.
Yeah. Well, and again, it's the people. What people need to remember is that real estate lags the economy. Real estate. A friend of mine said that often real estate looks back at what the economy did, and the stock market looks forward. And, you know, that's why, you know.
Very true. That's a great comment, by the way. That's a phenomenal comment, because it's absolutely true. The stock market today is looking at, you know, the extremely high likelihood that we get a weak vaccine, right, basically a 50% efficacy or greater within the next 6 months. So it's really looking at where we could be 12 months from now with all this stimulus and all this money floating around and you know, it needing yield. With that money's still going to be there. The government is not going to withdraw that $4 trillion. It's already given out to the people. Well, that money still exists. It's in the system. It needs yield a year from today. And when that vaccine is found, well, stock market's betting that the PE ratios are going to improve, which makes sense. From their perspective, it makes sense. I mean, I don't believe that the stock market today represents the Main Street. It represents, you know, rich people. And those people are looking forward at what's best for them, and they're making the right bets. But real estate, yeah, it has a bigger lag than the stock market. So keep in mind, U.S. real estate was the reason for the 2008 crash. We caused that crash. But when I ask people this trivia question, I'm going to throw it at you guys if you're okay with that. You know, when did real estate in the United States bottom out in the 2008 recession? What's your guess?
I would say, you want a month or just a year?
A quarter.
I would say fourth quarter of 2012.
You're very close. You're actually the closest that I've ever had. So it was the second quarter of 2012. But the recession really started in the second half of 2008. So bottom line is, it took 4 years for real estate to bottom out. And then since then, of course, you know, when it bottoms out like that for so long, then it obviously shoots up for eight or nine straight years. But I think that's the message that I send to people on these podcasts. There's just too many people talking about, ooh, dodged a bullet. Like, well, this is a slow bullet. It hasn't gotten to you yet. It hasn't hit you yet, yeah. Right? It's a bullet in slow motion, and it's still coming. I mean, there's nothing fundamentally changed about the bullet.
Yeah. Well, and in different places, it's going to be worse. I mean, part of the reason it's going to be so bad here also is that we just don't have the population close outside of Vegas to
right.
have those, like, we're going to go on a day trip to Vegas, which is where, like,
right.
a lot of the beach communities are. And, you know, those people, we have a lot of people in the short-term rental space, and they're doing well. And that's not going to happen. And even if we have a vaccine 6 months from now, people are still not going to come here. They're still not going to go, yep, going to get on a flight, because that's my feeling. In 6 months, even if I'm vaccinated, probably not going to take a cross-country plane ride until, like, I've seen what happens after everyone's been, or a lot of people have been vaccinated. Then I might fly. So we're just going to get, it's not coming back for a long time.
Yeah, it's going to take a while, and you know, it's going to hurt real bad. I think that you're absolutely right on this being one of those recessions. Sorry about the background noise. It'll stop in a minute. This being one of those recessions where different states are hurting at a completely different level, right? So yesterday I was looking at Utah's numbers. Davis County, where we're building a new industrial asset, is at 4.7% unemployment at the end of June. 4.7%. Detroit is at 40%, right? So 4 out of 10 people in Detroit. So there is one city worse than Las Vegas at this point in time, and that's Detroit, right? So Vegas is right after that, and then Orlando. And so when we're looking at these, we're seeing a pattern of cities that were fundamentally very, very strong before the pandemic with jobs are coming back faster. So Phoenix and Utah are leading the recovery, and so are places like Raleigh and Charlotte. I expected Austin to do better, but it seems to be in the middle of the pack, which is surprising to me. I thought that with so much tech, Austin would do better, but not so far. So where's the unemployment really low? It's low in Arizona, which refused to shut down. Basically, it traded lives for economic benefit. And one could say, purely from a heartless perspective, that it was the big winner, because unemployment rates are lower than 8% in all parts of, you know, Arizona, and some parts are as low as 5 or 6%. If you look at the top 10 cities in the U.S. with low unemployment, three are in Phoenix metro, right? So Tempe, Chandler, Mesa are in that top, you know, top 10. And so it seemed like that gamble that they took worked for them. And you might say, hey, no, the numbers there are pretty high now. Yeah, but they're not shutting down. What they're doing now is, you know, they're accepting mask mandates, and they're being more clever about it. We've definitely gotten smarter at it. We understand that closing bars has been that these are different kinds of impact levels, and we're beginning to learn from science and data and studies on which ones have the most impact and which ones have the least impact, and we're going to play the game better in the coming months. So that's the good news. We're going to play the game a lot better in the coming months. And then the second piece, I think, that is going to help places like Vegas come back. And, you know, I'm not in 100% agreement with you that people won't get on a plane after a vaccine, because there's a lot of pent-up demand for that kind of travel that we will see at that point of time. But the second thing is going to help us that no one's talking about now, but 3 months from now, I guarantee people will talk about it, is therapeutics. So there's two ways to fight COVID. One is get vaccinated so you don't get it. But the second one is to fight it with drugs when you do get it. And we are making very rapid progress on drug efficacy getting better. If we could, you know, if people went into the hospital right now, it's taking them 15 days in the hospital before either death or discharge, right? And that's killing our hospitals. I mean, I tell you, this is not about the deaths. And once again, it's a heartless comment, but I have to say that because we've already seen that some parts of the country are a little, you know, more heartless than the others. And it is what it is, right? And let's not get into the politics of it. But this is about the ICU bed count in the U.S. What is going to happen is that the politicians and the business community are going to drive the opening to the point where we have no ICU beds left. And then they're going to have to pull off, because at that point, the screaming and the yelling that comes from the general public is going to stop them from, you know, going further. So the ICU bed count of the U.S. is what is really driving the U.S. economy today. Mm-hmm. And if we had therapeutics, drugs that were twice as good, guess what that means? We just doubled the ICU count in the United States, which means that we could open a lot more. So the good news is that we are making better progress on therapeutics and on vaccines simply because fundamentally vaccines are hard. Mm-hmm. Drugs are not. Drugs, you know, can get into the marketplace much sooner than vaccines can, because if you mess up a vaccine and you vaccinate people, how do vaccines work? I mean, you inject people with COVID-19. That's how vaccines work, right?
Yep.
Well, you make a mistake on that, you screw the whole world. But if you make a mistake on a drug, you kill a few patients, which is why drugs come into the marketplace much faster than vaccines do. And so I think in 3 to 4 months, you're going to see some very powerful drugs, some cocktails that are going to get better, remdesivir mixed up with hydroxychloroquine or whatever it is that seems to work. And you're going to see hospital stays shrink. And when that happens, we're going to be able to open our economy more, because this is all about ICU beds at this point in time. Nothing else matters.
Yeah. And your point is not so much about the general public, you know, reaction to COVID and all that. It's just that the damage is already done to most of these businesses. I mean, that most of their balance sheet, the damage is already done.
I mean, if you look at every business that was a, let's say, we'll talk about haircutting salons, we'll talk about gym owners. Well, some of them haven't paid their you know, their landlords, but let's say that they got rent for free. Let's assume the best case scenario. They still had to pay employees, and rent is not your only cost. There's dozens of other costs. There's insurance. There's, you know, utilities. There's so many costs. And what's happening is that a lot of these businesses were healthy. They had $100,000 in the bank. They had $50,000 in the bank. And what's going to happen is by the time we get to that vaccine, that $100,000 gets down to zero, right? And now they're borrowing from mom and dad and everybody else. So effectively, their balance sheet is negative, right? And then if something else unrelated to COVID happens, a bankruptcy in Cook County in Chicago happens, you know, a large company goes under because of, you know, this impact, they will not be able to sustain that impact. So a lot of the dominoes are going to keep falling after a vaccine, because at this point we've weakened that portion of the economy, right? So that's the bad news, that this impact goes on for a while. The good news is I think that we are getting better at fighting this thing. I mean, I'm seeing the therapeutics are getting better. At this point, I mean, 2 months ago I was saying, I don't think we get a vaccine this year. I think it's just nonsense. I think that the speed at which vaccines work, there's no past evidence that a vaccine can be made this quickly. Today, I'm going to say I was wrong. I was wrong 2 months ago because the rule book is just being thrown out as far as the vaccine creation is concerned. We went, you know, Jillian and I were on a webinar in late April, or I think it was May, and she and I were talking, and at that point there were 9 or 10 vaccine candidates that were in human trials. That number has jumped to 42.
Wow.
Right? Because this is such a worldwide problem, as far as I'm concerned, we only need one out of 42 to work.
Yeah.
And if right now we'll take weak vaccines that are at 50% efficacy as well. So even less than 1%, one of them has to work. So bottom line is something's going to work. My bet is on Oxford University, AstraZeneca. I think they have a strong vaccine. The Pune guys in India have a very strong candidate. And the Chinese, who have had 3 extra months, Sinopec is a very strong candidate. So I think one of these 3 wins and we start – we don't get the vaccine yet, but keep in mind the news that a actual vaccine is in the marketplace creates a positive buzz. Real estate is based on consumer sentiment because people buy cars and homes when they feel good about themselves, they feel good about the economy. So just the consumer sentiment boost that you get from the announcement that a candidate has been approved by some FDA somewhere in the world is going to give us months of boost in spending. And that's what the economy needs right now. So there's the good news is coming sooner, even though the vaccine might take a while to get to us to actually be in our bloodstream.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I never thought about that. It really is a worldwide, so many people are going after it, whereas typically...
Everyone's obsessed, right?
Yeah,
I mean, and everyone's breaking the rules. Like the FDA just simply has taken the rule book of vaccination is like... I know. All right. So who wants to do human trials? Great. So when do you want to start? Tomorrow morning? Okay. Can you start tonight?
Yeah.
Right? So,
yeah.
I mean, it's amazing what is happening, right? All the red tape is just gone when it comes from vaccination.
Yeah. Okay. So what do we, you know, you are still investing, correct? I mean, you're doing a development deal. You're doing a, you're still investing. What do we do with all that information? If for somebody that wants to continue investing, how are we managing our downside risk?
So, you know, your audience, Neil, I mean, a lot of them are interested in from a value add perspective. So maybe I can start right there. So I'll start with value add multifamily, and then we can kind of talk construction. We can talk about other asset classes if they're interested in student housing or whatever. I think that it's not a bad time to buy multifamily, but you have to understand this, that there's a lot of people saying, hey, prices are not falling yet. Prices haven't fallen. Maybe we shouldn't keep waiting. Well, understand what I'm about to say. So the first month where net operating income of multifamily was affected was April, right? March, there was really no impact. People had already paid rent before the bad news came out. So April is the first month where we saw tenants realizing they didn't have to pay or they couldn't pay. We started getting, you know, layoffs. So March, so April, May, June, and, you know, so far, obviously July numbers haven't come out. So if you look at a multifamily that is on sale today, they send you a T12, which has 12 months of rent rolls, and you basically are going to buy it based on that, right? Well, only 3 out of those 12 months at this point are damaged goods, right? The remaining 9 months are pristine and, you know, in the middle of a boom. Well, so what that happens is today, they don't have to drop the price much because you're looking at the aggregate 12 month and only 3 months are damaged. Well, then a month later, it's 4 months, and then it's five, and then it's six. So the price drops are automatic. There's nobody dropping prices. It's just a million people use Excel spreadsheets, and what they do is they look at two things. They look at the prevailing cap rate of the marketplace, which seems to be rock steady at this point in time. It's not dropping. It's not changing. And then they look at the net operating income. And people might say, yeah, but Neil, if we keep hearing things like, well, you know, occupancy is not dropped at all. We're at the same occupancy, and most people are paying rent, and, you know, the delinquency is only up 5 or 10%. Well, my message for you folks is this. Almost all the profit in multifamily is in the last 20% of occupancy, the occupancy between 80 and 100. And U.S. multifamily occupancy was already at 95 and trending down slowly because, you know, prices have gone up a lot. So out of that 20%, which really is 100% of your profit, you had lost a quarter before the pandemic hit. So now that three quarters of income, it's basically the occupancy. And when I say occupancy, I mean economic occupancy, people that are paying, not people that are sitting there not paying you. So when you look at economic occupancy, you weren't at 95. That was physical. You were at 92 because there was already delinquency before. Now you'd lost 40% of your potential income, right, already before the pandemic. Now that 92 is going into the mid-80s. So when you were at 92, so for a moment, understand this. All of the money you're making is from 80 to 92. Okay, so let's call it $12. Your income is 12 bucks. So now, post-pandemic, your income is going to go from 92 to, let's say, 86. Okay, and most of that impact is not physical vacancy. It's economic vacancy, people not paying you. So your 12 bucks has become 6 bucks. So if your 12 bucks became 6 bucks, didn't your net operating income fall by half? Right?
Yeah.
So when someone's going to buy that property, as each month goes by and more of your income is at that 86% level rather than that 92, wouldn't the price automatically drop each month? Nothing to do with cap rates. I mean, no one in the U.S. is talking about cap rates dropping, but because multifamily prices are simply a very simple multiplication between net operating income multiplied by cap rate equals price. And if one of those is dropping every single month, which is happening all across the board, well, then prices will drop every single month. There is nothing more to it. Prices don't need to drop. They will drop because net operating income is dropping, right? So we are at a different NOI level. So bottom line is, it's inevitable that every month the deals will get better into multifamily. And in my mind, the best deals are going to be in July 2021, 1 year from now. Why? Because 1 year from now, so think about it, April's the first month when you got, you know, your T12s basically got hammered, which means next year in March, right, is going to be the time when you have 12 months of the post-pandemic, right, T12s. And by that time, I believe a vaccine would be found. So the last few months of those may not be as bad as the first few months that we are experiencing right now. So it's actually going to be mending at that point. So now you have 12 months of T12. And if somebody basically says, okay, I'm going to take these 12 months and put my property up for sale in May or June, well, you're going to be making offers in June and buying in July, right? Mm-hmm. So that's probably the low point, the absolute low point at that point. And if the recovery is much faster, much, much faster than I think, then the low point gets moved. It may not be July. It might be a little bit earlier than that. But bottom line is, if you're buying, understand that you're buying an asset which is going to go down in price. There is no analyst at this point predicting multifamily prices will stay stable. CBRE, down. Marcus & Millichap, down. Cushman, down. The banks, down, right? So if you're looking at Berkadia or you're looking at all of these guys, Fannie Mae down, Freddie Mac down. If you want to buy it, that's fine. But you're going to buy in a market where decline is guaranteed.
Yeah.
Right? That's my message for you. Is it a good time to buy? Well, and I'll tell you why. 4 months ago, me and a bunch of other people and you guys were basically fighting, sellers. I mean, it was totally a seller's market. We had $100,000 in deposits due on day one, sight unseen, and then basically they were giving us 60 days to close. Today, that same seller's like, oh, no, you know, take your 30 days. I don't need any money hard. And I'll give you two extensions if you need to close, because he doesn't want you to wait another 2 months, because he knows that his price is going to go down every single month. So they're like giving you all the time. He just wants to get you in contract and get maybe 50 grand in his pocket. So you now have some reason not to walk away from this. So in that sense, you're actually in a better market, right? Mm-hmm. So it's a weird sort of thing. Do you look at it as glass half empty? Do you look at it as glass half full? I can guarantee that the best deals are in the future. They're not there today. But if you buy today, you're in a better place than you were in Feb. So which way do you look at it? I don't know. I'm looking at it as my company is not going out of business in the next 6 months. I don't need the acquisition fee, so I'm just going to sit here and wait.
Yeah.
Well,
right? And you might say, well, what am I doing in the meantime? And the answer is, luckily, I'm also a developer. And the development world in some ways is having the best of this, because I have never signed development loans at 4% before. I mean, development loans are always more expensive, but right now they're just ridiculously cheap, right? And 4.25% you can get a $30 million building built. And we don't have to deal with any of these super onerous impounds. You know, Fannie and Freddie are like saying, I want 9 months of principal and I want 9 months of interest and I want you to give that to me up front and I'll give that back to you whenever I feel like it, right? The world has no such concept. Right? They're like, yeah, that's fine. I mean, if you get a loan, you get a loan. We'll fund it. So to me, I think the best thing that you could be doing if you were a developer, please, for God's sake, don't do this if you're not a developer, because the development market is a very tough market, right? That's a terrible reason to get into development. But if you are a developer, you get to skip this year, right? So I'm building in Mesa. Mesa already has the strongest rent growth in the United States post-COVID, right? So give or take a city or two of strongest growth in the U.S. post-COVID. But I'm not delivering anything for 19 months. So to me, I get to have the incredible benefit of much lower interest rates than I projected. Mm-hmm. And I also get to see an economy on the upswing 19 months from now when I'm leasing up,
yeah.
Right? So I think that from that perspective, I think development's in a good place. The downside is if today you can't get development loans unless you have a track record. So it's a horrible time to be a new developer, because banks are simply only working with folks that they know. So a lot of banks are simply like, we're not going to work with you unless we've already loaned to you before.
Yeah.
Well, and what you're really talking about is also what's your time horizon? You know, I mean, if you're somebody who has had a multifamily deal that you bought 4 years ago and that loan is due a year from now, the term ends the year from now, and that's when the exit was supposed to happen, you're going to be hurting. If you're somebody,
you're going to be hurting, and you're going to be hurting big time, because you're not going to be able to refinance that property. And one of the reasons for that is, I mean, hopefully you have multiple extensions, right? But keep in mind, people say this stuff like, we have multiple extensions. What they should be saying is, we have multiple extensions as long as we perform to a certain level. Banks are not idiots. They're not just letting you get extensions for free. Those extensions, have you read the language in your contract? It says things like, you have to have rents to a certain level. You have to have occupancy to a certain level. You have to have delinquency to a certain level. So if you're not going to have any of those things, then you're actually not eligible for that extension. Now, having said that, banks don't want to take properties back. So if you do a good job of running your property, even if you don't hit that benchmark, you come in 10% less, I can almost guarantee they will give you that extension. Because the banks know a year from now that the situation is on its way up, right? So we've been in a trough, horrible trough, down, 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 and now we're beginning to go up. So when a bank sees that, if they see you managing the property well, even if you're below that threshold, they'll probably let you extend. But the message I have for everybody is, yes, if you were due to extend your loan or to refinance in Q1, Q2 of next year, you're going to have a really tough time. So you'd better be aggressively working on your property right now.
Yeah, gotcha. Okay. So we have covered the economy. I mean, more than as much as we can in a little, 45 minute podcast. But, I know for a fact that you are an outsourcing expert. And last, I think I spoke to you, I think you had 25 virtual assistants. It's probably more now.
But it's 25 employees and 19 of them are full-time virtual assistants. So there's 19 employees that we have that are basically they live in the Philippines or the Ukraine or they live in India and they work full-time for us, U.S. hours. So one of the things that we have always mandated is you might be the best virtual assistant in the U.S., but if you don't work U.S. hours, we can't have you work for us.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So they all work U.S. hours.
So what sort of ways are you using them? I mean, I know you have, I've communicated with your, one or two of your assistants by email and scheduling, how they handle your scheduling. What are some of the other ways that you're using virtual assistants to leverage their time?
Honest answer is the way we use virtual assistants. Firstly, we don't like using that word inside of our company. They're just team members. That word itself creates a culture problem. And so we only use that word when we're outside of the company. Inside the company, they're team members. We simply refuse to think of them as VAs. They're just, they're just people in the company. And because of that, there's very few things we don't use them for. So it might actually be beneficial to flip that question and say, what do we not use them for? Firstly, we don't allow people that live outside the U.S. to do bank transactions, so they don't have access to our bank accounts. In certain cases, they have read-only access because they're transaction coordinators, so they can go in and look at incoming wires from investors. So believe it or not, all documents for investors are being handled by virtual assistants. Now, as you can imagine, they are the most senior. They're the ones we trust the most. But still, they don't have access to money. But do they have access to people's W-2s? Yes. They have access to Social Security numbers? Yes. So we've got two or three that are that have risen to the top over years of service with us that do that. So investor management, that's in the Philippines. When investors come in, we get about 4 or 5 investors a day, right? So we are very high throughput when it comes to investors. So those 4 or 5 investors are first processed by a virtual assistant and then set up with a US-based investor relations manager. So imagine my investor relations manager always says he's got the best job on earth because he just goes from call to call to call to call to call. All the pre-work, qualifying investors, making sure they're accredited, making sure that they're actually the right people, that they actually want our services, that they weren't just, looking on the internet and found us, doing all of that work, answering their initial questions, telling them about us, all of that is virtual assistance. Scheduling the call, reminding people that they have a call is virtual assistance. Doing the call, US-based staff. And then the hundreds of steps that happen after is, again, virtual assistance. Right. So tagging them in the database, sending them more information, setting them up for future calls, sending them information about our projects. All of that stuff is being handled by virtual assistants. And you might say, well, why don't you have the virtual assistant do the investor relations management as well? Honest answer is they can do it just fine. But we still have clients in the U.S. that don't know what a virtual assistant is. They don't get the warm and fuzzy feeling speaking to somebody from the Philippines. So we have to kind of adjust for that. But can the virtual assistant do an investor relations manager's job? Hell yeah. They absolutely can. So that's on the investor relations side. And then we have an army of them, like 10 of them, that are focused on marketing, on investor marketing, right? So this podcast, when Neil's going to send this podcast to me, I'm just going to put it, I'm going to type one word at the top, of my email. I'm going to send this to Asana Marketing, which is Asana Marketing is an actual folder in Asana, which has tasks. And I'm going to copy the person whose primary job it is to take this podcast and process it. So now, once I do that, somebody comes into work in the morning. It's like, oh, Neil sent me a new podcast from Neil Henderson. Great. So he's going to read your email. He's going to take out all the content. He's going to go into different software like Canva. He's going to create a custom header with my picture and your picture, do all of that stuff. He's then going to basically go into another folder where we have like 18 different places that we post these podcasts. One person's going to convert it for use on our YouTube channel because that looks different and has that spiky, fun equalizer thingy going right at the screen. So he's going to do that or she's going to do that. And other people are going to be like, okay, let's post it on Facebook. But Facebook is not Facebook. Facebook is Facebooks. It's, you know, we're going to post this on Neil's page, the Grow Capitalist page, the Multibagical Multifamily group, you know, all of these other groups. There's other groups that actually allow us to post our content. We go out and post it there. And then they're going to take it and repurpose it for Instagram. Then they're going to take it and repurpose it for email. So we if it's some interesting quote that I've said, they're going to repurpose that, right? Imagine all of this stuff multiplied by about 1,000 recurring tasks that are set up in Asana. Mm-hmm. They're doing those. And they're doing it with very minimal, you know, supervision from other people because they've done it 1,000 times before.
Yeah.
Right? So, and that's just podcasting. Podcasting is one of our 12 funnels. We have 12 different funnels. One of them is podcasting. And I don't even have a podcast. And I never want to have a podcast. You know, people say, what's your podcast, Neil? And my podcast is called Everyone Else's Podcast.
Right? Yeah. No, it's a great
podcast. And I love that. Everyone Else's Podcast is better in my opinion. So, you know, I'm on podcasts all the time. So I'm spending the same amount of time that I would do on my own podcast. But I'm basically going on to other people's, you know, events. But that's one channel, right? So we have Facebook as a channel from a social media perspective. So they're not just putting podcasts on our Facebook groups. They're running our Facebook groups. They're answering hundreds of questions. They're doing that thing on Monday which says, hey, post your deal. That's a virtual assistant. On Tuesdays, they're posting the motivational message. You see those nice messages of people running and the moon and the sky. That's all virtual assistants, right? And Wednesday, they're probably doing something else like they're asking like questions which create, you know, people are talking, and then they're answering those questions. Believe it, they get over their knee, right? A lot of people say, Neil, I think you just waste your whole day on the social media. And my answer is, I am never on social media.
Yeah.
I don't even do social media for my personal stuff. I mean, my family knows that I will never answer them on social media because I'm not really there. It's other people.
Yeah.
Right? Awesome. And this is not unusual. I mean, when you go look at, you know, people that have 10 million or 20 million Twitter followers, 99% of what's being posted and 99% of what's, you know, being answered are other people.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's a clever, it's the best way to do it, if, especially as you grow. I mean, we know because we're very small and it takes forever to do any, like to reprocess and, you know, post, make things into different little packages and post them everywhere. And like, We're trying, but we also have a 6-year-old that is home with us, and Neil has a full-time job, and so like it.
And by the way, we also invest in real estate.
Yeah, you know. Yeah. There's a lot of things to do, so it's a great tool to have, and there's nothing wrong with using people. I hate that people don't get a warm fuzzy feeling about someone just because they're in another country. That doesn't mean that that they aren't just as skilled as someone who is in the U.S., but...
Well, I can tell you, one of those people, I'm not going to give you her name. I don't want her to get poached. because they're in other places and investors would not like it, they don't have access. None of these people have access to bank accounts for investments. She has access to my personal bank accounts. So I trust her more than any assistant. I've had lots of assistants in the last 20 years of running businesses in the U.S. that were U.S.-based. Yeah. She's the first to ever get access to my bank accounts. I mean, I don't find there being a difference in ethics and a difference in competency. It's just a difference in cost. That's really all there is. And a lot of people, you know, they're like, yeah, but my virtual assistant experience wasn't good. You really have to dig into that yourself. In my mind, if you're a good teacher, if you're a good organizer, your experience will be good. If you're a bad teacher and a bad organizer, your experience will be bad. And you try and make up for that by hiring a person in the U.S. that is sitting next to you, in the chair next to you. So now, without teaching them, you're basically wasting massive amounts of time with them, basically wasting time watching you and learning from you, right? that's inefficient, but that's the standard. We basically have people come in and say, yeah, you can learn, just sit here and watch me do stuff and eventually you'll learn it. Sure, anybody can do that, right? But that's not the right way to do things. The right way is to actually spend structured time creating systems and processes and tutorials for people. And if you're able to do that, then what's the difference between doing it for people in the Philippines and doing it for people sitting next to you? Yeah. Right? And what people don't realize is that what you're doing by having a person sitting next to you and following you is the worst, because the moment that person leaves, the clock, you know, basically you're starting from scratch again. Whereas if you create the systems and processes and these video tutorials that we create every single day, those are all stored in Asana. So when a person goes away, Asana is a project management software. All we have to do is new person basically takes the John left. So you click on John and say reassign tasks for John to click, and you select the new person. Now all the tasks are there. And you might say, well, how does a person know how to do the task? Well, that's because we never create a project without a video tutorial that's recorded using a software called Loom. Loom is a free software. It's an applet for the Chrome browser. It's always in the top right, left, right side of our browser. We click on Loom. It's now recording our video. It's recording our screen and our voice. And I can tell you in 2 to 3 minutes, you can teach an incredible amount of process. It would probably take you 2 to 3 hours to write that as a process, because now you'd have to type it out and fix your typos and do screenshots, and it's going to take forever, and most people don't do it. So as far as we're concerned, our process is very simple. The people that are teaching only ever use Loom, but the people that the teaching is going to have to then convert that into a written document with screenshots. So I'm spending 3 minutes. They might be spending 3 hours, but they're doing it at $5 an hour. So then they send that back to me, and I might spend 5 minutes editing that. Because what we learned a very long time ago is if you force people to do these complex how-to documents, they just don't do them. They find an excuse, right? Yeah. So we're just standardized on three-minute videos. If it's longer than 3 minutes, create a new video, because you're too verbose.
Yeah. Okay. So, you know, if you've got somebody starting out, wants to start off with a virtual assistant, let's say they're a small podcaster, you know, with a family at home and a 6-year-old and a self-storage business, you know, they're trying to get started off the ground.
Sounds familiar.
Yeah. How would you tell that person to dip their toe into, the world of a remote team member?
So, you know, when you were growing up, you went to college, you didn't argue about spending massive amounts of money and spending 4 years of your life in college. You think about it, 4 years is 8,000 hours, right? But you spend it. You knew that was a good investment. So the first thing I want to say is, virtual assistants are the most magical things that you can ever believe when it comes to both your personal life and your professional life. But they are an investment. People can say, I'm just going to hire an assistant, and I'm going to go to Upwork, and I'm going to post something, and then I will basically see how it goes. That's the wrong approach, because you haven't burned your bridges. When you sign up for a college and you move into the dorm, you burned your bridges. Right? That's what made college work. So my message to you is, if you're using a virtual assistant, burn your bridges. How do you do that? Don't hire one, hire two, and hire them for 4 hours a day. Because the key thing is, I want a huge amount of pressure on you to make them productive. They're not the problem. You are. You're the problem, right? So when you have two virtual assistants, and you're paying them 4 hours a day, that's 8 hours multiplied by $5, let's say $40 a day, okay? And I can tell you the first month is all going to be wasted money. Let's assume 100% of it is wasted. So you basically wasted about $1,800, okay, at 100% wastage. That's your investment. That $1,800 is virtual assistant university, because during that first month, you'll force yourself to learn what you need to do to make these people efficient, and you're going to learn what you need to do to set systems and processes. And most importantly, that month, when you're throwing money down this endless pit, it's going to force you to be creative and say, what portions of my life and my business can I automate? You need to ask yourself that question a million times, because that question is specific to you. It can't be specific to anybody else. The answers, there's no book that has the answers. You've got the answers in your head. And you need that month to come up with all the answers. I pretty much guarantee that if you follow this process, at the end of that month, you'll have lost $1,800, but you would have gained virtual assistants. And then why two? Because one of them often leaves. And the moment they leave, you have to replace them. So what I tell people is, do them 2 hours a day, do them 4 hours a day, but get two virtual assistants. Mm-hmm. Because one's better than the other. So when you need to fire them, you're not going to hesitate.
Yeah.
Because people, they have bad experiences because they don't fire the virtual assistants that they should be firing. You hire two, you can now compare. You fire one, you rehire the second one, you keep growing with that process, and eventually you end up with two that you like. That's going to be awesome for a while. And then, unfortunately, one of them will leave. Then you'll have to start that process again.
It's almost like you're A-B testing them as you're doing it.
Yes. A-B testing is really key with virtual assistants. We found that we had virtual assistants in a position for a year, and we thought they were awesome. And the moment they left or we fired them, we realized that they were crappy.
Mm.
Gotcha.
Yeah, because you didn't have the...
Something to compare to.
Compare to. That makes sense. That's awesome.
Well, Neil Bawa, thank you so much for joining us. If any of our listeners want to reach out to you and find out more about you, what would be the best way for them to do that?
Well, two ways. They're both very simple. First one, just Google my name. As I said, I'm the only Neil Bawa on the internet. So NEALBAWA, hit enter. You'll see about 100 podcasts. You'll probably see about 30 or 40 conferences where I'm teaching live. And that'll kind of get you started, right? There's also some, I'm known for my controversial thoughts. And whenever I have a controversial thought, I write something on the internet. So you'll get to see plenty of interesting things there. And then the second way is, we believe in education. We're very, very strong on education. So we built Multifamily University, which is multifamilyu.com, as a website for all things real estate. It started out as all things multifamily, and then our audience grew, and they really wanted more than multifamily. So it's really all things real estate, especially commercial real estate. We do single family only about 3 to 4 weeks a year, but the rest of the time it's about commercial. We do 40 deep dive webinars and town halls. People love them. This year, 75,000 people will sign up for our webinars, and town halls. Average attendance is always exactly the same, 500, because that's how many people we can put in our Zoom license. Everybody else, we send them Facebook links. So we have 300 or 400 people watching on Facebook because they couldn't get into the Zoom link. So whenever you sign up, you'll notice that there's a Zoom link. And then below that is like, if Zoom doesn't let you in, click this link so you can watch through Facebook. But the key is not the fact that it's a large audience. The key and questions, obviously, with a large audience are better in quality. And usually we spend 45 minutes answering questions in each of these webinars. But I think it's about the depth. We are very fanatic about our webinars being deep in content because we find that there's too much shallow stuff that goes on in real estate. When I switch from tech to real estate, incredible. And so I hunger for that depth. So a lot of our conversations are very deep, and some of them are topics that you wouldn't think about. I mean, I believe, for example, that in 2008, the banking system changed real estate forever for all of us. And so we have a webinar on that and has nothing to do with real estate. It just has to do with the impact of the banking system, because we think that those are things that people should think about or know about. So some of the topics are crazy off the wall, and we enjoy that process. We are, you know, the mad scientists, and we like to be true to our reputation.
No, I think it's true just right here in this podcast. I mean, we went into things that people – we've talked COVID and all this with other people, but we really got into some subjects that we've never touched on in context to that, and it's been really interesting. So thank you.
All right.
Fantastic.
Well, Neil,
thanks
again
for having me on the podcast.
Yeah, it's been great. Okay, that was Neil Bawa from GrowCapitus and Multifamily University. It was wonderful chatting with him. I'm glad that we were able to get him on. He's a very in-demand speaker, although, of course, he admitted that he basically just doesn't podcast. He just goes on other people's podcasts.
Hey, it's a good strategy.
It
makes
a good
sense.
Yeah.
If you're able to do that,
yeah.
You know. Someday.
Yep.
Maybe.
Yep. So we're, this is a little bit different. We didn't really get into Neil's background in real estate and talk about the four values, the money, the time, the knowledge, and, you know, whether I could do anything. But
I mean, I could guess on some of those. He probably travels.
Yeah.
He has, because he has people that can run his things. He probably spends a lot of time on this because it seems like he super enjoys it. And I think it's probably a full-time job for him.
Yeah.
And he's definitely not a passive investor. And money, he probably spends a lot of it.
Yeah. There you go.
Spend $5 an hour.
Yeah.
For 8 hours.
Yes.
Of virtual assistants a day. Start there.
Yep. Yep. So is that your biggest lesson learned?
No. I mean, you could just like pull things from about every 5 minutes in the podcast and be like, oh, that was neat. That I never thought about that. He's clearly a super intelligent man and has a lot of background in, he's like at a different level than some people, us. and he has a lot of deep thoughts. I think one of the things that I, you know, found interesting now, like he's like, politics aside, here's the heartless, here's, you know, this is where places are doing well and where they're not and why, and kind of, it was interesting to see that. It's hard to separate some of that, and, you know, and he was able to explain it that way. Now, does he separate that in his like normal life and how he's thinking? I don't know. I don't know what his, you know, politics or any of that is, you know. I've got emotional things about some of that stuff, but it was interesting to look at it from purely a business standpoint, mm-hmm. and not have, you know, not thinking about the deaths and all of that nuance. So I just thought it was a lesson learned that it's, you should look at that because it is going to affect the economy, the things that are going on. And you can still make a decision to say, I'm not going to, you know, capitalize on that if you feel like it's against your values or something like that. But you should know it. You should look at that effect because it's going to affect also long term.
Yeah. Well, it's also important to remember that, Neil, when you're dealing with other people's capital, when other people are trusting you with their capital, it's very important to, you know, I mean, there's often times where you do need to look at things from a very analytical standpoint. And I think that was how I describe Neil's take on that, is very analytically, you know, you have to look at the places that are less shut down or maybe having more deaths, but their economies are doing better.
Yeah.
For him as an investor going forward and somebody who is in charge, who's been given the privilege of handling other people's money and livelihoods, then that's something that he needs to keep in mind.
Yeah, yeah. Totally understandable. So
for me, I need to hire a VA.
Yeah, yeah. I know it's hard because, you know, for us personally, we sold our house. Our child can no longer go to school. Personally, we don't feel like that's a good fit for our family, whether he can go back to school physically or, you know, if that, I don't think that's an option here
it's
in Cloud County, County anyway, but even if it was an option, it would not be what we would choose for our child just based on living with an older immune compromised person and the experience that I want my child to have, and we're very privileged for being able to do that anyway. But when I also ended up having to step back from my job, which was in a medical field for some of the same reasons, and also to take care of our child because we also can't have child care for the same reasons and do his school for him. Part of it was our thought was that I could do some of these things. Is it worth me doing that? Because it's becoming clear after about a month that it's going to be incredibly difficult because our child is starved for attention and it's not the same as if this was a normal non-COVID time and we were able to go to play dates or, you know, homeschool co-ops, I could probably balance this a little bit better. I'm struggling right now. it's only been a month and we won't be able to figure it out. But if we can maybe take this lesson and say, okay, maybe we should do this and actually use it. I know we've used some services and some people before, but just talking to them, I'm wondering if we use those effectively. And maybe it's our fault that it was costing a lot of money for something that didn't feel, you know, so that's maybe going too personal for into like our specific, but I think it's something you have to think about. You know, like that is where we're coming from and our, how we're going to maybe take this and make an adjustment. And then we just have to decide how much we want to invest in it. And, and if that's an investment that we want to make for our goals and that kind of thing. So, you know, I definitely think it's a conversation that we have to sit down and really think about and have. And I'm grateful that we got to have this experience with Neil and kind of go,
The other key lesson learned for me on a larger standpoint would be, you know, we got in the beginning, we really talked about the economy and COVID's effects on it. And a lot of people, there's a lot of people in real estate and just the economy in general right now who are going, you know, well, the stock market's not going down. Well, home prices aren't going down. Everything must be okay. Well, and it's very important to remember that real estate lags the overall economy. And I, this was a point I made, which is also stocks look forward. The people who are investing in stocks are predicting that the economy is going to be better at some point in the future, that these companies are going to be okay in the future.
Yeah, we can guess that Disney will probably be fine eventually because people will go back to Disneyland and Disney World and Disney cruises and all those things. So, you know, if we'd been able to, I would have, like, bought all the Disney stock when it was in the hole. You know, but, you know, the stocks are probably still decent for Disney because they're going to be here, Home Depot, all those places. They're going to be around because they're not probably, they're also probably not over leveraged.
You hope.
You hope.
I mean, Disney has gone through some bad times in the past. They're a huge company with huge operations, you know, so I don't know what their balance sheet looks like. And that's the point that one of the points that Neil made is that there's a lot of these companies who the damage has already been done on their balance sheet. It doesn't matter. The economy could, you know, we could have a vaccine tomorrow and everybody gets inoculated. But a lot of these companies are already in a lot of trouble. Okay, so we had a little
technical
brief Zoom
thing.
Crash there. So we were talking about Disney and
you were saying that the you were saying that the damage is already done, and I was about to say that, you know, that is what Neil said, but he said that the damage is already done, and but and they may still be operating. The problem is if they don't have a safety net. So if something then happens again, and I would refute that in as far as Disney goes. There'd be very few things, hiccups that could happen that would completely destroy Disney. Hopefully they have a big safety net, but like as soon as people can, they're going to get back on a Disney cruise. I'm sure there's people, I don't know if it's open anymore, but with Disney World, I'm sure people went. Once the weird restrictions get adjusted and aren't quite so shut down, you know, things aren't quite so big. People will go back. And also Disney has its fingers in a lot of different places. There's still Disney Plus. There's still, you know, TV shows. There was Donald Duck on a kid's Zevia soda that that my kid drinks as a treat. Like, they're probably not going down, but it is. But you do have to think about other companies. So, you know, the casinos here, if they're in a bad place and then something else happens, you know, our local economy drops more, they might not be able to weather that storm. So that I think was the point. But anything else that you feel like was really that you wanted to touch more on or thought was really important to take away from this interview?
No, I think we covered most of it. Again, just everyone is waiting. Everyone's thinking that we're headed towards a real estate crash that's just like 2008. And as Neil brought up, is that 2008, the crash was caused by real estate.
Yeah.
And this is much more an underlying upset. I mean, it's a black swan. I mean, there's a lot of people that, Nicholas Nassim Taleb would say, no, this wasn't a black swan. We knew that something
It could happen, but we weren't prepared for it. We didn't have systems set up to have something different happen, and the market wasn't prepared for it. So the market, you know, the proverbial mind of the market didn't see it as something coming. So even if individuals knew that it could be a possibility, the market as a whole, it wasn't in the realm of possibility. So this is something that is an external hit, not an internal hit. Like 2008 was more what was happening inside real estate. This is an external issue that is affecting real estate. And from what I understood, if I understand what he was saying, it's more of a short-term effect for some places. Again, like Vegas here, he was saying Detroit, it might be longer term, but it seemed like he was saying that within, you know, 18 months, we're probably going to see a turnaround and things are going to go back to where they start going up, possibly. Obviously, he's not a mind reader, but the man is very smart.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed talking to him.
And one other point I remembered was that he talked about long-term, we still have $4 trillion worth of stimulus that was injected into the U.S. economy alone and another $10 trillion worldwide. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times what happens when you inject that much money into an economy is inflation happens.
Mm-hmm.
One of the reasons that we like investing in real estate is it's a hedge against inflation, because unfortunately what happens when you have inflation is prices rise, rents rise,
mm-hmm.
home prices rise.
Yeah.
And if you can get in and buy a property, I'm not saying buy right now, that's not what I'm saying, but if you can buy in the past for interest rates that are low during a time of low inflationary period, and you have a period of high inflation, what happens is that interest rate stays low, but you start to see a growth in the gap between your rent and the price, and that's what you're looking for.
Yeah. All awesome. Right. All right.
Okay, well, once again, that was Neil Bawa from Grow Capitus and Multifamily University. Look him up. And we're doing this all again next week.
Let's hit the road.
Bye. Hey, before you go, if you like the show, we would be delighted if you'd head over to Podchaser and leave us an honest review. And do let us know why you like the show, how long you've been listening, and in particular, what you find really useful or entertaining. And let us know if there's anything you think we should change. Also, if you have specific questions about real estate investing, especially self-storage or short-term rentals, shoot us an email at info@roadtofamilyfreedom.com, and we'll be happy to answer your question on the show. We might even turn it into an entire episode.
Thanks for listening. We're doing this all again next week. Until then, safe travels.